I'm Roxy Manning.
And I'm Sarah Payton. We are the hosts of the Fierce Compassion podcast. In this episode of Fierce Compassion, we talk with Mary Frances Winters, founder and CEO of the Winters Group, who takes us on a journey of discovery of the last 30 years of diversity and inclusion work with organizations and corporations. In her work, she is inspired by the new generations coming up and allows herself to learn from them.
In this session, we get to hear from Mary Frances the importance of honoring your uniqueness and following your passion.
We discuss the difference between kindness and toxic niceness and how centering niceness can impede equity work.
We dive into the necessity of knowing oneself while still situating the self in the systems that we're part of in order to challenge inequitable systems with a compassionate frame that keeps everyone in dialogue.
Mary Frances shares strategies on how to invite curiosity and openness in people with dominant identities and when and why we might want to use the question, how would you know?
And she leaves us with some deep self-reflection questions that can support those folks from the dominant culture who want to show up as aspiring allies in anti-racism.
Join us to celebrate what is possible when we commit to kind and authentic calling in. We welcome Mary Frances Winters, founder and CEO of the Winters Group, Inc., a 39-year-old global organization for development and diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice, who truly believes that diversity and inclusion is her work, is her passion and calling. Named a thought leader in the field, for the past three decades, she has impacted over hundreds of organizations and thousands of individuals with her thought-provoking message and her approach to diversity and inclusion. Ms. Winters is a master strategist with experience in strategic planning, change management, diversity, organization development, training and facilitation, systems thinking, and qualitative and quantitative research methods. She is the author of seven books on anti-racist conversations and on the impact of racism, including the books Black Exhaustion and We Can't Talk About That at Work.
Ah, so Mary Frances, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ah, thank you. Well, we'd like to jump right in and ask every guest this question. How do you define self-compassion? What role has it played in your work and in your life?
You are the experts on self-compassion. So but how do I define self-compassion? I think, you know, it really starts with self-love and being able to accept who you are and that you are a unique emanation of the Creator and that there are no two like you. And so I think if you can start there, then we can, you know, move towards compassion. We're not necessarily, particularly my generation, baby boomer generation, I don't think we're particularly taught to be self-compassionate. So it's something that I've had to go back and really work on and learn.
There's something in this definition that you're saying around like self-love and that accepting our uniqueness, which already speaks to accepting and embracing the diversity that all human beings represent.
Right. No two of us are exactly alike. And we spend our lives. One of my books, Only What Babies Like Change, that I wrote back in 2002, I talk about how we try to compare ourselves, you know, and compete, you know, with others. And the world, this capitalistic world, really leads us to, you know, to do that. We have all sorts of systems in place that focus on comparing and competing rather than looking at what do I bring that no one else brings and how can I offer that to the world? What's my contribution? You know, what's my purpose on Earth, the time that I have? And really finding that unique purpose and then going for it rather than comparing yourself to what someone else has done, is doing, Allow them to be great at that, and you be great at whatever it is that you feel is your calling. Yeah. I don't know that we work enough at really contemplating and reflecting on what am I called to do.
How did you discover what you were called to do? What's the origin story of you having such a lovely place in this work?
Well, I didn't come at it easily. I resisted it, and probably about maybe 25 years ago now, I was walking down the streets of Harlem with a friend, and I was complaining about the diversity work and complaining about how hard it is, and that you know, why can't people recognize the beauty in diversity? And I said, I'm going to get into some other business. I can't do this anymore. And this friend said to me, did you ever consider that maybe this is your calling? Wow, that was a jolt. Mm. That was a real jolt. I said, no, I never looked at it that way. And I started to look at it that way. And it's interesting how the universe colludes to help you continue on the path or get on the path that you should be on. And right at the same time, I got a message. I believe it was a note, a written note, mail. You know, back 25 years ago, we were still using mail. And I got something in the mail from someone. And she said, you probably don't remember me. She said, but we worked together and you had such a profound impact on my life, the way that you were able to help me to understand that diversity, as I did write a book called Inclusion Starts with I, and so that it's the individual. And she said, you just really had a profound impact on my life. And I was like, no, to myself, no, I don't remember you. Mm-hmm. But I do remember, you know, this idea that if you can make an impact on just one person, if you can, you know, support or help one person, then my living shall not be in vain. There's a song that goes along with that. Can help somebody. My mother used to sing it. If I can help somebody along the way, then my living shall not be in vain. So that one transformative moment when somebody said to me, do you think that might be your calling, is what really helped me to say, okay, let me live into this. Let me embrace this rather than trying to move away from it. And rather than trying to think of all the reasons why I shouldn't be in this work, let me reverse that. And I think of all of the reasons that I should.
Was it something like an invitation to make it your own?
It was. It was indeed, right, to make it my own and to do it in my way and not compare or compete with others, you know, who are doing it. So I don't even, you know, pay much attention to my competitors in this space anymore. I mean, when I say pay much attention, I mean in that way, in a right. competitive way. And, you know, there's been a lot more collaboration with others in this space.
I'm curious, like when you think about how you've made it your own, what would you say is unique about your approach?
I would say, well, we did do a survey not too long ago, and we call it the secret sauce survey. Because we wanted to know what it was that made us different, the Winters group different. And the answer was interesting, was shocking to me. But the answer was that we don't tell our clients what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. We tell them what they need to hear. Mm. And so I think my ability, and to do it well with compassion and with kindness, I think my ability to be very transparent and to be very open and honest about, you know, the organization that they may be leading or the dilemma that they might be in, and not sugarcoat. I think we, particularly American culture, particularly dominant group American culture, tends to be indirect in communication. Mm-hmm. And I tend to be very direct in communication.
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of continuing with this idea about the corporations, like you said, you tend to be super direct. You kind of get right to the chase. Mm-hmm. And one of the group agreements that I've heard you begin with is send to those most impacted by systems of oppression. Mm-hmm. How did you learn that you needed to begin with this agreement? And how do you set that up with your clients?
So I learned from my younger colleagues, the young activists in this work have a very different approach. So I can't claim that that was one of mine. I got it from one of the people who works for me. But the idea, we tend to be, particularly in the Western world, we tend to be very individualistic in a way that doesn't allow us necessarily to think about the plight of others. And so we just talked about, the self-compassion, but I don't want to conflate that with selfishness, or narcissism or, something along those lines. So I think it's important, but contrasted to the ability to look beyond ourselves, but you have to know yourself first. You have to have that self-love first, be able to look beyond yourself. Because if you don't have that, then it all does become about me and you become that victim. So centering those who are most impacted, particularly when we're working in dominant group spaces where they may not be thinking about those who have been most impacted by oppression. Not that they're bad people, that they just may not be us aware. And so we start with a commitment in our sessions, center the experiences of those most impacted. And so if you're in an organization where it's a male-dominated organization and you don't have many women in the organization or women's voices have not been heard, we're asking you to center the experiences. And so when you're listening, listen to hear and understand those experiences and not to become defensive or relate back to your own experiences. And so that's a difficult one, but we feel it's a necessary agreement in the kind of work that we do, the anti-racism work. We hear so much, well, yes, I do hear so much that, I'm not a racist and nobody is saying that you're a racist. But again, that's that, and if you really do understand yourself and you really have done that self work, you wouldn't say that, mm-hmm. You would be open to recognizing that you may have some obstruction spots, that there may be areas where your behavior is racist. But, that's the most horrible word for, term for anybody in our society today to be called. Don't call me a racist. I'm not a racist. And I don't think we're going to be able to address this problem until we can get past that. It's not personal necessarily. We're talking about systems, but those systems are comprised of people. So you've got to go back to the unit, right? The unit starts with self, right? So yeah, so it's complex, and it is difficult for people to hear, to center, because they feel that that's preferential treatment. Everybody should be equal. Equal means we treat everybody the same. Equity means we look at the needs differently based on the needs of different individuals in different groups. Mm-hmm. Equity is a tough one for particularly here in the United States. That's a tough one.
Yeah, and there's something about. There's something about the way that you talk about the self, right? The importance of both knowing ourselves, mm-hmm. being able to understand who we are, and still choose to have this orientation that's around the system, not right. just like centering myself, but putting myself in part of the system.
Right. How am I colluding with that system, right? What is my contribution? What's my role in the system?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just thinking about how often people are defensive, especially if you're working in the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. And it seems like you get the opportunity to do that a lot in mm-hmm. your organization. What have you found? Like, what is effective when people are defensive? What, how do you kind of invite them back to something better? What are your strategies?
So we, you know, the compassionate part of the work that you all do as well. I think we're compassionate. We affirm or validate or, you know, accept, that this is how I feel. Let's take an example of a white male, you know, dominant group individual, who says something like, well, you know, I grew up poor. And so, you know, I don't have privilege. And so we then try to, we accept that. And we then try to help understand that, it's not a binary. Either you have it or you don't. You can have privilege in certain aspects of your life and not in other aspects of your life. So I invite people to be open, you know, to understanding. We also, you know, use the age old method of, query, you know, can you tell me a little bit more about that? You know, thank you. Thank you for your perspective. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
So then you're up sort of up against a dilemma in some ways, which is that you had mentioned that in the dominant culture, there's a lot of indirectness. And I wonder if that relates for you with the concept of niceness and how that's toxic. Are you willing to say a few words about that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as you all know, you do this work very well too, but kindness and niceness are two different things, right? I can be kind and it may not necessarily be your definition of nice, because I may be kind and be giving you some feedback that you might think is not nice, right? And so I think that, you know, making those distinctions between kindness and niceness is important. And I think from a self awareness perspective and a self-understanding and a self-critique, the willingness as we are loving ourselves, at the same time, be willing to critique ourselves, be willing to admit that we have work to do, you know, for ourselves. I also say that, I liken it to a normal distribution curve. And I say that, you know, there's this big group of people in the middle, the 66% and, you know, in the middle of the normal distribution curve. And you do a scattergram, they're all over the place, but they're willing to learn and to be open to other perspectives. Mm-hmm. You've got the extremes, and we're seeing those extremes play out in our politics, obviously, today. I don't know what to do with those extremes, and I don't try because it's too much of a burden. And so we work with the people who presumably are in the middle somewhere that 66, 68%, that, you know, normal distribution curve. But again, they're all over the place too, right? So that's a big group. But I don't work at the extremes. I don't try to get avowed white supremacists to listen, and I don't listen to them. Mm-hmm. It's too much of a burden.
I think it's also part of honoring what you'd said earlier, like, what is my calling? What's my passion? Mm-hmm. And it's not to like try to shift the needle a tiny little bit for the people who are stuck. Mm-hmm. It's to say, right, how can I help those folks who are interested in wanting to do this,
exactly,
to learn how to do it?
Right. Exactly. Those who are willing and willing to admit that, you know, that I have a lot to learn. And then we get into that, but who's your teacher? And some of my younger colleagues, some of the Gen Xers are saying, I mean, not Gen Xers, the Gen Zs, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. The Gen Zs are saying, I'm not your teacher. You know, you need to go learn someplace else. Yeah. So as a baby boomer, though, when I first started hearing that from the Gen Z, I said, I'm not.
But I think
it's a part of my calling. I am.
Exactly. I was going to say the same thing, because I feel that's part of my calling. I always tell people, it's not your job to teach anybody you don't want to teach. And I want to honor that. And just because I'm doing this isn't a demand that you have to do it. Right.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Can I go back to what you had said about kindness and niceness? Because I think that distinction is one that people often don't get. Mm-hmm. And I'd love you to define, how do you see those differently a little more?
So I see kindness as being sort of a core kind of a value, sort of a underlying way to be and way to live, right? kindness to me means that you do care about others and their plight, and you're willing to help in the way that you can. Everybody helps in a different way, or supports the well-being of others in different ways. So that's kindness. I think it's aligned with compassion from my perspective. Niceness, I think, is more situational. It's more like in a given situation. So kindness is that deeper. It's kind of like happiness and joy. You know, joy is a deep sort of overall sort of way that you experience the world with joy. Happiness is like temporal. It's like, you know, I'm happy. So if I have joy in my life, doesn't mean that I'm not unhappy sometimes. Right.
Right.
If I'm kind, that doesn't mean that maybe I am perceived as not nice sometimes, because if somebody, you know, if somebody, let's say somebody is doing harm to one of my children or something, or saying something, you know, I'm probably not going to be very nice at that moment. So again, it's situational, but that doesn't mean that I'm not a kind person. That doesn't mean I don't have a kind spirit.
I wonder if part of this distinction that you're making, and it really resonates around the kind of temporal versus orientation. So mm-hmm. kindness is my orientation to hold other people with mm-hmm. compassion, to right. almost like see the good in them and to trust
right.
each other.
Exactly. Yeah.
And niceness is around, it's almost like not actually being real with what's in the moment. Like when I'm being nice, I might just be always wanting you to feel safe or feel comfortable, mm-hmm. but I'm not being real about this is what
exactly.
I need to call out in the moment.
Right. Yeah.
This is reminding me of the differentiation, Roxy, that you make about negative peace and positive peace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
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 I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just for our listeners, you know, this is talking about some of what Dr. King talked about, you know, many, many years ago around whether or not we're going to be nice and let everyone think that everything's okay, even while some people are suffering, or if we're going to go for real peace, positive peace that's around mm-hmm. calling out harm when it's happening,
right.
even if it doesn't feel nice. So, yeah, right. that really matches what I'm hearing you say, Mary Frances.
So you mentioned calling out. And so we also in our practice talk about calling in, mm-hmm. calling people in and not just calling people out. Because when we call people out, so what I like to say is that if we just punish people for their quote, bad behavior, I'm just using bad because I can't think of another word right now, for their bad behavior, they've said something wrong and they get punished, they lose their jobs, they lose their contract. If we continue to do that, that's calling people out. We're never going to get anywhere because other people will just shut down to say, oh, goodness, you know, I don't want to have that fate happen to me. And so I think we call people in, and that's where I think, you know, some of the query comes in, you know, can you just tell me, you know, more about that? I'm interested in your perspective on that. You know, to give an example, when somebody says, when a dominant group person says, well, I don't think racism exists anymore. And I don't think there is racism. Mm-hmm. My calling in on that is to ask, how would you know?
Great question.
And that usually stops them right there, you know, and I don't mean it. And I do mean it in a kind way. I mean, what, you know, if you've not walked in the shoes of a person of color, if you've not walked in the shoes of a brown or a black person, but you're in power, these are people who are in power to influence and to affect change. And what is your evidence? You know, how do you know? Right.
Yeah. This feels really amazing for me. And I want to like really emphasize this piece that you're naming, that if we only respond, like people are going to do things that are racist. They're going to say things that
right.
are hard. And we know that's just part of the world of what we've got. And if we respond by like stomping on people, punishing them, then they're not going to want to show up and say, whoa, I did this thing, because the costs are too big. And I love that you're saying we have to find a way to keep people engaged in the room and not afraid. And at the same time, I'm curious what your thoughts are around, you know, I've heard people tell me, well, if they're not afraid, they're just going to keep doing it. There's no reason for them to learn. Mm-hmm. So how do you respond to that kind of pushback?
Well, I don't think we want people to be afraid. It's not about inciting fear. I think what we want people to be is curious, and we want people to be you know, like I said, open. So I don't want to instill the fear, you know, instill fear in them. I want them to have breakthroughs where they're able to see the world differently, when they're able to see something from a perspective that they could never, that they didn't see it. They didn't see it that way before. So I've opened something up for them to say, ah, I never thought about it that way, you know, before.
I'm going to talk about one of your books now. In your book, Racial Justice at Work, you write about how marketing and procurement, philanthropy, and IT have these deeply embedded policies and practices and ways of being that create conditions that actually uphold the status quo. And what are some ways that you see this playing out?
So I can give the example of procurement. Mm-hmm. Actually, that chapter was written by Marisha Reese, who happens to be my daughter and president of the Winters Group. Mm-hmm. I gave the opportunity to, I think 12 other staff members actually have chapters in the book. I wanted to amplify the voices of some of my younger team members. So Racial Justice at Work is a book that was co-authored by me and others. I just wanted to acknowledge that. But let's take procurement. So many big organizations have what they call supplier diversity programs. And a supplier diversity program is an intentional program to seek out historically underrepresented business owners, vendors. And they set goals to utilize a certain percentage of underrepresented business owners as they're buying goods and services for their companies. So that's a great program. It's been around for years and years and years, and it has helped many companies. So then what happens is that you have the finance people who make decisions about payment terms. And so when I first started business 39 years ago, the standard payment terms were 30 days net. Well, then they became 60 days net. Then they became 90 days net. And now we have some of our clients are 120 days. They pay in 120 days. So we ask the question when we talk about racial justice, who does the policy or practice benefit and who does it harm? So obviously it benefits the large corporation because they keep their money longer, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, more for them. Who does it harm? Many times women-owned businesses, many times BIPOC-owned businesses are small businesses. And they may not have the cash flow to go 120 days for work that has already been performed. Mm-hmm. And so that is an example of racial injustice at work. Now, who would it help if the policies went back to more reasonable policies of, you know, net 30 days? Well, it helps everybody. It helps all businesses, not just the BIPOC and the women-owned businesses. Mm-hmm. And so we have clients who have said, well, if you come to us with a hardship, we'll talk about it. Well, that's an extra burden. That's an extra thing that we have to do. To mm-hmm. say, well, we would like you to pay us sooner, and so then we have to fill out paperwork, and you have to do all of this. Why should we have to do that? So, thinking about who does it benefit, who does it harm? For IT, you know, it has to do with the various, what's going on right now with artificial intelligence mm-hmm. and the various algorithms that get developed, and algorithms that get developed where they put in, let's say that you're going for a mortgage, right? Mm-hmm. And so they put in all of these different factors, your how long you've had this job, they put in your credit score and da, 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 and they come out with a formula. Boom. Oh no, you don't qualify. But that doesn't take into account the interlocking systems that perhaps created what this algorithm has looked at. We also know that some of the algorithms will delete posts that are about Black Lives Matter, but do not delete posts about white Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And this is the way, again, it's set up in the, in the algorithm. There for marketing, again, I'm talking about, again, social media and how we market today. But if you looked up, this has changed, but if you looked up Black women, you would see images of Black women who were shown very, what's the word, in very sexy kind of, you know, positions. And you would not, in other words, you would not see professional, quote, professional Black women looking like in business suits or like they're, you know, like they're in business. Again, that's how the algorithms, you know, were set up. And there are many, many, many other examples. And in my book, Black Fatigue, How Racism Erodes the Mind, Body, and Spirit, I talk about financial services and well, just navigating the world. And so there's a saying that Black men get locked up and Black women get locked out. So the eviction rates for Black women are much higher. And then when you look at the policies that are set in place, and some of this does get into the IT sometimes as well, but the policies that are set into place, if you've had an eviction on your record, then it's very hard to get another apartment. So what about all the costs? So you've had to perhaps store your furniture. Your children have now had to go to a different school. So for men, Black men who get evicted, they oftentimes, well, I don't know about oftentimes, but they sometimes will talk to the landlord and say, hey, I'll do some work around here and I'll, you know, do maintenance work. For Black women, that often becomes, what are the favors? They become sexual favors. Mm. Yeah. So the system, the system.
Yeah. And it's also the system and who it's benefiting. Like, even when I think about some of that, it's not around compassion and kindness in the way that I think is important around helping to lift up everyone in our society. It's around what little piece can I get that's to my advantage, even if it's my big business getting, you know, that 2% interest for the 4 months instead of giving you this money that makes a huge difference.
Right.
And all the way to, like, I get free labor, I get free sexual contact. So it's always around, can we shift from what benefits me to what's really holding the whole?
Right. Yeah.
Mm. What is it like for folks who are in your trainings? How do they respond to these invitations that you give them to have compassion for themselves, to discover their own authenticity? What's it like? How do people respond?
It's difficult, particularly when we're working with the larger, you know, male dominated organizations. You know, the stereotype of the macho male, you know, I don't want all that touchy feely stuff. Just tell me what I'm supposed to do. And so we do get pushback on some of the exercises and the experiential work around self-awareness and self-understanding. We get considerable pushback on that, primarily, and I'm just going to be honest, you know, because that's how I am, but primarily from white males. And then they complain it was the facilitator, it was the content. And so we deal every single day with somebody calling from one of our clients to say, Charlie didn't like when the facilitator said this, or da 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 da. And, you know, Charlie hasn't recognized that he needs to do his own work, and he doesn't want to do his own work, so he projects it onto, it was us. We were the ones who should not be allowed to continue this work in that organization.
Yeah.
So it's challenging.
Yeah.
And even more challenging today because of all of the rhetoric around woke and, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion is bad. There are organizations who are no longer even using the word diversity.
Are they still doing the work, or did they just stop altogether?
They've slowed. Definitely, it's definitely slowed. Definitely. Yeah.
Wow. I just want to take a moment. I just feel so sad about that impact. What's the timing for you in the industry? When did it begin to slow? Was it when we elected Trump? Was it, did it take a little time after that? What's the timeline?
Well, there was definitely a big push to do this work after the George Floyd murder. We were so busy that we couldn't keep up. We hired more people. And it was just, you know, we had to say, you know, it's going to take us a while to respond to you. So it was just a really, really big push for that from 2020, 2021. I think it started to slow already in 2022, and it's definitely continued to slow. We have hear comments like, are we still talking about that?
Interesting. Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah. Or we may hear, you know, things like, well, we have to talk about more than just race, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, my perspective is, well, we've been talking about more than just race for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And when do we get to talk about race? One of my clients likened it this way. She said, 2020, she said, we're on finally main stage. You know, race gets to be on the main stage. And, you know, everybody's like looking at, oh, my goodness, we're finally going to have honest conversations about race. Then she said, here we are, 2023. We've been yanked from the main stage. Mm-hmm. So the reason that we were put on main stage, she said, was a traumatic situation. And now we're being re-traumatized because now you can no longer have these discussions. Don't want to talk about them. I had one client. I was working with a top leadership team. And we started to talk about anti-racism and the history of racism. And she said, stop. She said, I didn't know this session was going to be about, you know, racism. I didn't know that's what we were going to talk about. When did we decide we were going to talk about that?
Wow.
And that's what we were hired to talk about. And so we soon after lost the contract, we were fired mm-hmm. for doing what we were asked to do because it makes our leaders uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. That's what we hear all the time. This conversation makes our leaders uncomfortable.
And there's something so infuriating in some ways about that, because if you're in a position of power and you're uncomfortable having these conversations, when we're trying to tell you that it's impacting every person under you, especially people with historically marginalized identities, it's like you're prioritizing your comfort over exactly changing the experience of your employees.
Exactly. Right. So here's my question about that. What are you uncomfortable about? This is how I answer that. Ask that. What are you uncomfortable about? What is the source of your discomfort? Because oftentimes the people that we're dealing with who hire us are not at the level, they're lower level in the organization, and they just come back to us and say, well, our leaders are uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But nobody, they don't have the answer. Yeah. What is their source of their discomfort?
Well, what do you think it is? Like, what have you heard?
I think the source of the discomfort, I think there is some guilt and shame, perhaps. And I don't really know, to be honest with you. I don't really know. It's always been a difficult, you know, conversation. We have a sordid history, you know, around the world, but in the United States, obviously, with race and racism. And if I don't have to face it, I have the privilege to not have to face it. Mm-hmm. You know, then I choose not to.
Yeah. When you say that, it reminds me of this idea that it's not that the conversation, like people kind of say, well, this conversation is bad. It's not that the conversation is bad. The conversation is necessary. It's that you haven't done your work so that you can have this difficult conversation.
Right.
And so it's
right.
like we take our discomfort and we push it onto the thing right. and we shut that down rather
right.
than increasing our skills.
Right. And so we do have an offering here at the Winters Group called Bold Inclusive Conversations Certification. So one of the books that I wrote is called We Can't Talk About That at Work, How to Talk About Race, Religion, Politics, and Other Polarizing Topics. And we have a program that helps people to facilitate those conversations. But most of the people who come to those sessions are the people who don't need to have the mm-hmm. skill. I already have the skill.
Mm-hmm. The people who are having these conversations all the time because of who they are.
Exactly. But are so relieved to have a place where they can really do it.
Right. Yes. So true.
Yeah. I was so intrigued when I read what you wrote. You wrote, I never stop interrogating the ways my thoughts, speech, and behavior collude with white supremacy culture. And of course, I am in a continual dialogue with myself, with my own white supremacy culture. It comes out very clearly so often, even in these beautiful interviews. Do you have anything that you're willing to say about what recent learnings have been, or about your...
Yeah, the learnings are just, you know, really ongoing. I think, you know, one of the areas that I'm trying to unlearn is the sense of urgency. So being in a small, you know, owned business for all these years, you know, it's been difficult. I mean, you know, the business is up, the business is down. This year, the business is down. And so that sense of urgency, you've got to get a contract, got to get a contract, is something that I'm working on. And to be honest with you, my team is really helping me. Again, I have a lot of millennial and Gen Zs on my team who actually resist. And the idea that rest and self-care is so, you know, so important. That wasn't anything that was a priority for me over these years, because I needed to make a living. And so, you know, getting up at 4:30 in the morning and working until 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, and perhaps not taking care of my health. I mean, my health is fine, but not to the extent that I may have should have taken care of my health. Those are all things that I've learned that I have to, and I do have faith. I mean, I do know that if I put something into the universe, a desire, and I focus on that desire, that is going to come to pass. However, when you have 15, 16 people whose livelihood is dependent on you being able to pay them every 2 weeks, that sense of urgency, you know, can come out. I was taught that. I was taught, as a matter of fact, some of my clients years ago used to have that as one of their values, sense of urgency, you know? So I think that's one that, that is difficult. And the balancing between what the client wants.
I want to celebrate the naming of this, though, because it's, you know, that it's sort of, there's a surprise in it that's wonderful.
There is, right, to be able to name it.
And then you can say, sorry, I interrupted. What was your
name? No, I was just going to say, and having that, but to actually have that conversation with dominant group people is really, really difficult oftentimes, because they will push back on, you know, perfectionism is another sort of characteristic, right? And yes, of course, we want to be, why wouldn't we want to strive for perfectionism, right? Why is that a bad thing? And I think one of the people on my team, Kevin Carter, who's the vice president of our strategy and assessments, will say in excess, right? So these are things that's in excess, right? So if you're doing these, again, who's harmed and who benefits. There are studies that show that Black employees in a manufacturing environment, so they're on the line, right? Mm-hmm. They're more apt to be punished for mistakes than white. I mean, there's just like a lot of evidence of that. And so this whole idea of, you know, perfectionism to a fault, you know, is something that I work on as well, because you want excellence. You absolutely want excellence. Yeah. But, and how do you handle, so it gets to, how do you handle mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. How are mistakes looked at?
I'm really like just moved, like listening to you talk about this, because I see it happening in two places. So when I look at myself and I hear you talk about perfectionism and urgency and, you know, like working from 4:30 to midnight, mm-hmm. it's this idea that it's almost like I had this belief, I need to do these things. Right. I need to show up perfect because I'm going to be judged. Just like exactly. those Black folks on the line are going to be judged. I'm going to be judged if I am not perfect. Right. And so that's one of the ways that we can dismantle for ourselves how it lives inside of us.
Exactly. Yeah. We tend to overcompensate or overdo because of our lived experiences, right? And our parents' lived experiences and what we've been taught. You have to be better than.
Yeah. Right? And it feels like such a risk.
Right. You have to be better than that dominant group person. You know, you've got to be twice as good to get half as far. That's a saying, right? That we've heard over the generations, right?
But I'm so appreciating that there's now an awareness that that has not served us. It has not served our communities, and that we need to change it. The other thing that's coming up for me, though, is also the flip side of it, which is like when I hear you talk about like those old companies that would have urgency as mm-hmm. part of their values, I often had a sense when I worked with organizations that they would have these values, but who it applied to and what it meant also mm-hmm. changed, right? So mm-hmm. it was like urgency on the backs of folks with less power, folks with marginalized identities who are doing the work, who are the ones who have to be perfect. The mm-hmm. ones with power get to make mistakes.
Exactly. Right. And they, when they make mistakes, they get big money for it.
Yeah.
They get the golden parachute, right? They get mm-hmm. they may get fired, but they're going to get fired and take $20 million with them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I used to say, fire me for that.
Yeah. So a lot of ways to explore these concepts, like how these concepts of white supremacy culture both live inside of us mm-hmm. and also where we apply it and where we don't.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. I want to actually talk a little bit now around who's inspired you. Like a lot of the work that I do is kind of grounded in Dr. King's concept of beloved community. And so that's one something really dear to me. I'm curious if that's important to you and who else has inspired you.
Yeah, absolutely. The beloved community and oh my goodness. I'm not at home, so I can't look to at my bookshelf, but he inspired Dr. King too. He was the president of Morehouse College at one time, not Benjamin Mays, but, Benjamin Mays inspired me, as well. Some current people, My Grandmother's Hands author,
Reshma Menakem, yeah.
Right. He has inspired me. Richard Wright. When I was in high school, I read Richard Wright's Native Son. Mm-hmm. So that's been something that that book absolutely, turned my whole life around.
What did you take? Like, how did it impact you?
So I grew up in Niagara Falls, New York. It's not a large Black community. My whole street was, and my church was, but it wasn't really a large Black community. His lived experience, bigger, I think, was the lived experience of the protagonist in that novel. It just really, I just had not ever had a perspective that those kinds of things could happen, you know. And I know it was a novel, but still, you know, there was a lot of realism to it as well. So those are, of course, Toni Morrison, has inspired me.
Part of what I'm getting is I hear the names that you're saying are people who made our lived experience visible and said, what you're going through is real. It happens. It's
right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. And do you want to say a little bit about how beloved community shows up in the work that you do, if at all?
So part of what we do is we build community. We call it community before content. And so we try to do, so this is a, you know, very kind of granular everyday kind of the work that we do on a daily basis. We will have the group maybe do I am statements and talk about, you know, if I do a my I am statement, I am, you know, cisgender, heterosexual, African-American, baby boomer, mother, author, you know, so I would go through, you know, my I am. So that's one way that we try to build community, particularly in big organizations where people are so focused on the work, right? Mm-hmm. So we definitely try to, try to build community in the groups that we work with. And we are forming our own communities. We have a community of the people who have taken our Bold Inclusive Conversations course. We are developing a community around, we're calling it the Empowerment Institute, which is for BIPOC, early BIPOC leaders or those wanting to get into leadership. Mm-hmm. And that program starts in next May. And the community will be, the idea of this community is that you may not lead the dominant group way, but that doesn't mean that you're not a leader. So this offering is not about fixing you, but it's about finding you, finding who you truly are in your leadership style. So we know women have a different leadership style. People of color, you know, may come from more of a collectivist orientation than an individualistic orientation. The idea of storytelling and the importance of qualitative, not necessarily, you know, the capitalistic world is, the dominant group world is much more quantitative, you know, just give me the numbers, just give me the facts. So how do you understand that, but also embrace the idea that it's not just about the numbers, it's about the experiences that, you know, that people have had. So those are the kinds of things that we do around. So I think community is like really, it's in our core values of the Women's Group as well. And so I think the idea of the first thing that we think about when we're wanting to work with a group is how do we build mm-hmm. community?
Yes.
What are our shared values?
Mm-hmm. So here you are creating communities for the young folks coming up and for folks who are interested in having these bold and inclusive conversations. And what kinds of, when you're talking to somebody young and they say, I love this work, I want to do this work, they're coming up in this work, what do you tell them? What kinds of advice do you have for them?
It's more of what kind of advice do they have for me? Because they see. You know, I think the advice that I have for them is really about finding themselves and finding their calling, being willing to explore, experiment, make, quote, mistakes. I'm putting mistakes in quotes. Learning as much as they can, you know, about themselves and, you know, and others, and then finding that place that brings them pure joy.
What a delight. I've been really inspired through our whole conversation by that it's very obvious that you are learning from the young folks who are coming up in your organization.
Oh, absolutely.
Somehow it's just really fun for me to have that as a model to like go, oh yeah, let me turn towards the wisdom that's coming in.
One other thing about building community that we're doing, Live Inclusively Actualized, is it's our philanthropic arm. Mm-hmm. And so for the last, I guess it's been 4 years now, we give grants to organizations that are about uplifting people, whether it be from a, whether it be about, you know, poverty and economic mobility, children. And so to date, I think we've given away about $350,000. Mm-hmm. So it was very important to me to be able to give back. And we didn't form a 501c3, but we're doing it as a philanthropic arm, and a community foundation actually holds the funds for us so that
it's
all legal and everything. But so that's one way that we're looking at, you know, how to build community. How do we give back, you know, to those in the community who are still marginalized.
Yeah. Roxy, what kinds of things are up for?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually curious, what advice would you give to people in organizational settings, especially people with dominant identities who want to contribute to culture change within their organizations?
Yeah, with dominant identities, I know that, you know, allyship is a big thing these days, and people talk about being allies. I say, humble yourself and be an aspiring ally, because, you know, you can't just declare, and this is what I'm seeing happen, I'm an ally. Well, you know, what work have you done? You know, what do you really know about the groups that you want to be an allyship, you know, with? And so I think it really is about doing your own work, doing your own soul searching, What have you learned? Where have you learned that? Challenge, what you've learned. Do you know enough? We have what we call the 4E model. And this little 4E model, I came up with some number of years ago, and people just love it. I thought it was very simplistic. But the 4E model is exposure. Ask yourself, how much exposure have you had to communities and people who are not like you? And the second E is experience, because you can have exposure. I mean, the difference, it can be all around you, but that doesn't mean that you're having meaningful experiences with those who are, different from you. And the third one is education. And there's all sorts of ways to get education. People ask me at the end of training, so, well, what can I do? I don't know what to do next. Well, there are documentaries, there are books, there are all sorts of things, museums, there are all sorts of ways that you can continue the learning if you, are interested, if you have that interest. Because I say to people, I can bring the horse to water, I can't make the horse drink. And so we get criticism about our work that, well, it didn't really do anything. Well, you don't learn how to play the piano in one session. And so if you really, if you really are dedicated to this, so this is for the dominant group people, it's a journey, and it does take, commitment. You want to learn how to play golf, you don't just go to one golf lesson, right? And golf, I don't golf, but I hear that it's a very difficult. So there's the third E is education. The fourth E is empathy. And I say that you need those three E's in order for the fourth E to happen. If I don't know, you cannot empathize with me if you don't know anything about me. Right? No. If you don't know anything about my, you can sympathize, which is more about pity. You can sympathize, but you can't empathize with me. Right. And so the first three, exposure, experience, and education, allow us to get to the fourth E, which is empathy. And I'm just always a little bit, I don't know. I'm just a little bit leery about people when they say, yes, I can empathize, right? Well, can you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like that aspiring ally thing again. How about an aspiring empathizer?
Right.
Wow. Well,
I know we're coming to... Oh, sorry, Sarah, I'm cutting you off now.
No, go ahead. I just wanted to express appreciation.
Yeah, I see why people like this 4E model. But as we're coming to a close, I wonder what actions would you want our listeners to take, both in getting to know you and your work, and also just things that you think would be helpful for them?
Well, I think we've talked a lot about many of those things. Interrogate yourself. You've heard this broadcast, and just ask yourself, where am I? Have I had exposure and experience? Do I even want to have exposure and experience and education? Yeah. How would it benefit me? How am I benefiting the world? What is my contribution? What is my unique contribution that I want to leave? What's the legacy that I want to leave? What do I want people to know about me? What do I want people to say in my obituary?
Mm.
And so I think those are the things that I would ask people to think about. And, tonight, tomorrow, very soon, do something that would be very uncharacteristic for you to do in the name of the beloved community.
Mm. Oh, that's beautiful. Wow. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to, in honor of this decline in the demand among organizations for diversity training, I want to say to all the listeners, if you're in a company or a corporation or an organization, tell your people you're still interested. Say, I want the diversity training. It's really important to me. I noticed that it's fallen off. So I want to just put that call out. Yeah. Yeah. And so to our listeners also, please support diversity training in general, and please support this work in the world by going to our website, antiracistconversations.com, where you'll learn how to purchase our new books, How to Have Anti-Racist Conversations and The Anti-Racist Heart. And you'll learn about new classes, and you'll be able to subscribe to our podcast to stay current with our amazing guests. You'll be able to re-listen to this wonderful podcast that we got to do with Mary Frances Winters, which was a great delight. And thank you so much.